So apologies for the title. I was trying to be clever and obviously didn't succeed. I guess I had an office for an extended period next to Phil Anderson, both at Bell Labs and then again at Princeton. And that was a case of the two is very different, if anyone's interested in the sociology. So, okay.
Can you expand on that?
After. So I'm going to talk about a couple sort of big questions in biology. In fact, this is going to be more about questions than answers. So why is there so much biological diversity on all scales? Well, a lot of the diversity of things one sees is emphasized. And then since the DNA sequencing revolution, it became clear that there's enormous diversity among microbes, including in your gut. But even if you go down much lower scales, and I'll show an example, there's still enormous diversity. And that's the bit which I find most most puzzling. And somehow, if one doesn't understand that, one is not going to understand the origin of larger scale diversity on longer time scales, because it all starts with diversity within a species. But I'm also going to talk about a related question, which is a very simple one, very basic. If I'm in a fixed environment, and there's evolution in that environment, does it get fitter and fitter and then gradually slow down, going to some fitness peak, the typical caricature of it, or to some kind of stable ecology if there are many species, or what? Okay. So the goal here really is to try to limit, or possibly limit, which things one should be surprised by. Right? So one of the roles of models is really if one can make a sort of simple potential explanation for something, then one's less surprised by it, even if it's not a realistic model. And one can go from just-so models, as Francis Crick calls them, just-so in the Richard Kempling sense of something, how something could happen, but where you know it's got none of the right features, to caricature models where you hope you capture a few of the essential features and try to understand those. And I guess that was, I think, Phil's model definition was probably almost always the caricature models. Okay, so the example which I want to give of the extensive diversity within a species is this species, Perchlorococcus. It's a photosynthetic bacterium. There are rather a large number of them in the oceans. But it has some argument for being the most important organism on Earth. It fixes more carbon than all human croplands put together, so certainly more than any other species. And it's very simple. It's got a small genome. It wasn't discovered for a long time because it's so little, and so on. So this is my student, Alana Popular, who's been analyzing a lot of data on this, and there's all kinds of data, and this is some recent ones where there are lots of single cells which have been sequenced. And you can take a bucket full of water from the tropical oceans, and every cell that you pull out from it, or everyone people looked at, is different genetically of the Perchlorococcus. And some of them differ by, well, it's a little hard to know, but possibly of order 10 to the 8th years, as far as their common ancestor, and some of them you pull out are as close as a few hundred years. A few hundred years is the mixing time of the oceans globally. So on this time scale, everyone is being swirled around and potentially competing with each other, and you found very close relatives in the Atlantic and Pacific. And so there's a whole range of things. Some of them, these larger scale differences here, it's understood that the ecological role is clearly different. Some do better in higher light, and some do better in lower light. So why on Earth is there so much diversity here? Why doesn't survival of the fittest drive most of them extinct? They're mixing together, they're competing with each other, they're simple. Okay, so what are the traditional explanations for diversity in quotes? So the most traditional one is that there are lots of ecological niches, micro-niches to get more diversity. So for beetles, this is a rather compelling argument. Beetles are complicated things. They live in complicated environments. But most crucially, not all beetles live in the same place, so they don't compete with each other. They evolve separately and can do different things. Okay. But if you really try to push this down, you go, wait a minute, does it make sense by the time you talk about pico niches? Yoxo niches would correspond to every single genome for the different genome for the Perchlorococcus. And obviously, at some point, it gets absurd. And somehow, the whole concept is problematic when you're in a simple environment, relatively simple organisms that are all mixed together, where the gradient is smeared out by the mixing and so on. Another explanation is neutral ecology. So this is the idea that whole groups of species, and the most famous one is all trees in the Western Ghats in India, are somehow ecologically equivalent, and all of the differences between where they are and the numbers are to do with stochastic birth, death, and migration processes. This is a theory that has the advantage of predictions, which in some cases look rather good. However, it's clearly something that, if it is true, has to be sort of emergent from the evolution and the ecology rather than the fact that these trees are really equivalent. However, for bacteria with huge populations, the dynamics for this is just far too slow. You can just rule it out from the beginning. Okay. Another possible explanation is continual evolution. There's always evolution going on in big populations, and various people in this room have worked on this, and we're starting to understand quite a lot. However, it can't give rise to this huge range of genetic diversity. It's really hard to see how this could possibly do it over millions of years timescale. Okay. One which is often said is that pathogens promote diversity, and the pathogens for bacteria are viruses, which are phages. However, people talk in terms of specialists, that each one has its own specialist phage or generalist. It's not clear this is stable, and this is one of the ones I'm going to look at in some detail. Okay. But there's another possibility, appealing to this audience, perhaps that this kind of extensive diversity is a general consequence of biological complexity. But there one really needs scenarios, just scenarios, simple models, theory, and hopefully some robust understanding. So the biology so is certainly complex, whatever your definition is for complex it is. And one way of characterizing it is, in a real sense, it's very high dimensional. So if I look at the genome codes for the molecular phenotype, or nanophenotype, which is all the properties of the proteins, how they bind to each other, DNA, how they don't bind to each other, and so on. And that's very high dimensional. And then that gives rise to the organismic properties at the cell biology level, all the things which affect how it interacts with environment and how it affects its environment. And then there's a large dimension, but probably not nearly as big as this for simple organisms. Then there's sort of space of the environment, crudely maybe the number of chemicals in the environment that you interact with. Okay. So the basic assumption then, and following a lot of physics tradition, is that the complexities of the biology, the ecology, and most of all the evolutionary history will mean that differences in fitness between slightly different organisms, slightly different variants of the species, and between the dependencies on the environment, like change in environment, coupling with other biology, will all be sums of positive and negative contributions. Okay, this really has to be the case, because any mutation, say, that was beneficial always would have been discovered long ago, and all the species would have it. So this, in some sense, has to be the case. And so what we're, of course, like to try to do is to make use of that, picking out some of the key caricatures. And the natural one, is one of the starting points here, is to approximate these complexities of differences by randomness, and then hope there's some amount of universality in a very loose sense. So the basic questions then in high-dimensional biology. So the simplest is a situation where there are no spatial gradients, everywhere is the same, no temporal variations, or at least no temporal variations of the physics and the chemistry. Of course, can be temporal variations caused by the biology itself. Okay. So the first question is whether or not ecological feedback, so changing of the environment by the biology, can this give rise to continual evolution even without diversity? If you just had one strain, could that evolve forever, or would it just get slower and slower and slower? Okay. The next one is whether populations can sustain extensive diversity, so very high degree of diversity, even if there's not evolution going on, right? Well, not substantial evolution. And then, of course, putting these together, can high diversity evolve and the diversification continue? Okay. And then a question which is a little vague one, how much biological complexity is actually enough to give rise, if we can't convince ourselves that these can happen in simple models, how much complexity do we need? Okay, so the first is question about the continual evolution without diversity. By the way, please interrupt with questions. I'd rather not wait till the end. And I think I prepared something that was shorter than the allotted time, but I'm also not sure what time I started.
9:02,
okay, so that's useful enough. Okay. Okay, so this is the first question we'll address. Okay, so what is the simplest caricature of evolution? Well, if we're going to want to deal with the ecological interactions, we really want to think about evolving the properties, not the genome. Of course, that directly follows from it. So let's consider D-dimensional phenotype X here. Idealized, I've got a fixed environment. There's a fitness, or fitness differences, just difference in growth minus death rate, and our characterizes a fitness landscape. Only one genotype at a time, low mutation rate, you get a small effect mutation. If it's better, that one takes over, fast selection, and then you can get another mutation. So at any given time, there's one strain, except these little transients. So this is the evolution is just deterministically uphill. Okay, so we want to characterize this landscapes by some complex landscapes, and so that takes us into the regime. High-dimensional random landscapes where we've just got simple uphill dynamics. And, biologists are more optimistic. They go uphill instead of physicists with energy going downhill. I think they're more pessimistic in other ways. But anyway, so we wanted to just ask this. And this is something which, say, many of you are much more expert than I am. Okay. So going uphill in rugged high-dimensional fitness landscape. So one's caricature of a low-dimensional landscape is you go up and eventually you get to some fitness peak. You can have some saddles, which will separate which way you go. By the time you get to high dimensions, you can have second-order saddles and so on, which separate which saddles you go to. But that picture is really just completely wrong in high dimensions. And the intuition about it is very wrong. What happens in high dimensions is the fitness will gradually go up. It'll go near but saddles of lower and lower index, so with fewer and fewer positive eigenvalues. It'll keep wandering among them. The index will gradually go down. The fitness will gradually go up. It'll get slower and slower. And it'll never commit to any of the peaks. It'll end up sort of going wandering around the marginal peaks. It's, of course, then extremely sensitive to initial conditions and to perturbations. Okay. And this deterministic uphill behavior is not really changed if you say you've got mutations, you're doing stochastic gradient descent, which in some ways is more like quantum mechanical tunneling, and the picture basically stays the same. Okay. So, of course, we don't want that. We want to be able to allow the environment to change and some feedback from the evolution. So we now have the fitness, which is a function of the phenotype and the environment, okay, which they could be the concentrations of chemicals. Okay. Now, this is a quantity which is one of the most misleading terms in science. Even though it's got two S's, people tend to think of it and talk as if it's a single quantity. So I'm generally very against naming things ohms, but I'm trying to get in the literature calling it the fitnome. It suggests at least it's something complicated. It's a function of lots of things. At the very least, it's a function of the environment. And of course, that's the function of all the other biology. So even with a single species, and this is especially true with bacteria, the population changes the environment. If there weren't cyanobacteria, we wouldn't be here because we wouldn't have an oxygen atmosphere on the long time scale. Okay. So a simple approximation is with a single saturated population, it's grown up, it's clonal population, that the environment is just some function of the phenotype. So then a mutant comes in there. Its fitness now is in the environment set by the one that's already there. But there's a different fitness in that, it'll take over the population if this fitness is higher, and that will then change the environment, and it'll go along. So this means the phenospace dynamics is not gradient descent anymore because of this part associated with the changing of the environment. Okay. But you can define it simply a magnitude of the feedback is how strong the non-gradient terms are. Okay. So many of you can guess what's coming next. Okay, oh, so this simple caricature. So here's the saddles without environmental feedback. The trajectory goes along and goes near the saddle. But with environmental feedback, the trajectory starts coming near it, but then moves the saddle, and it goes in the other direction. Okay, so in general, one would expect that in these rugged landscapes, dynamics is controlled by the saddles. The small feedback will definitely have an effect. It can make it that you spiral into maxima and so on. Okay, but actually the effects are much more dramatic going back decades ago. And so the main statement is that with these rugged landscapes, any amount of environmental feedback in high dimensions and the infinite dimensions will give rise to what we call, in this context, Red Queen dynamics. The organisms have to keep running fast just to stay still. They evolve forever without slowing down. And a particular measure of this biologically is that the rate at which new mutations will come in and fix in the population and take over, the fitness flux will go to a constant at long times. Of course, initially the fitness will go up, the index of the saddles will go down, and at long times, the characteristic timescale here over which it forgets its past history and wanders all over the place is, of course, going to scale at some inverse power of delta. Okay, so this is the Red Queen dynamics. To those who've worked on these gradient flows with an extra piece put in that's non-gradient, this is not so surprising. Okay. But now we can ask how much complexity is needed. Clearly, a high-dimensional random landscape of P equals 3, whatever, is not a very good caricature for biology. It's a toy model for this. So let's make something which is slightly more of a caricature. Okay. And here I'm going to take advantage of the very high dimension of the cell biology. Okay, so within the cell, very high dimension of all the proteins, there are lots of constraints on there, and those constraints I'm going to write as some functions, each one constraint labeled by alpha here, and take the square of those, and the fitness associated with the constraints then is zero if I satisfy all of them, and I'm negative, so it's bad if I don't. The number of constraints is of order this dimension, so it's also very large. Okay. And then I'm going to take the simplest possible coupling to the environment. So the simplest coupling to the environment is a fitness landscape with a single peak. The vector of here's the organism that's coming into an environment. The vector here is just dotted into some vector, so it's a very low dimensional projection. The dimension of the environment is modest. It gets modified by the by the evolution. So this is the organism which is already in the environment, is dominating it, and this is the simplest possible modification, again, with a small parameter delta. Okay, so the peak has changed very slightly by the environment. Okay, so it's not clear that this one has the same behavior, but it turns out that if it's sufficiently constrained, if K over DM is sufficiently large, you again get red queen evolution, and it keeps going forever, and it wanders over the whole of the of phenotype space. So it wanders all over the place. And I think this is actually, in some sense, an explanation for why proteins have what people call neutral evolution. They just seem to wander around in genome space for no particular purpose. I suspect it's really, and this is a caricature of that. Okay. So now I want to turn to the next question, which is, again, with no spatial gradient temporal variations, can populations generically sustain extensive diversity? Okay, so for here, again, we're going to take the baby one first. We're going to assume we've got a whole lot of closely related organisms. We're going to bring them together and ask, can they coexist? Okay. And this work was done with three talented graduate students in here in different environments. So the most basic one is where I've got one species or two species, as we'll talk about, with closely related subtypes, right? So we're not interested in the many species here. Well, we are, but we're not talking about that. We're going to look within the one species. Okay. So this is now modeling of the interactions between many types. So I've got types here labeled by alpha. Species here, because that's what this is for. So I'm going to consider a large number of types, K types here. N alpha is just the population of type of alpha. And the population dynamics, if these numbers are all big, the population dynamics is roughly deterministic. And this is just generalized Lotka-Volterra dynamics. So each population has a basic growth rate. It's because of competition and resources with its siblings, there's a carrying capacity the maximum would be. And then there are interactions with all of the others. Okay, so this is the classic way the problem is written down. And you know, in some sense, these terms are weak, or at least not too strong, and the dominant competition is here. Okay. But this really assumes, from writing it down this way, that each one has its own niche, right? Each one is mainly interacting with itself and less with the others, and that's the condition that this quantity here is much bigger than these. But of course, if there are many strains there or many species, the number of yours is going to be much smaller than the total number, and so these can easily come in and dominate. Okay. So this was studied by Bob May and others, particularly in treating this in the approximation that it has some average value and some randomness. And what is found is that if you set this fixed, and you have this being much smaller than it, and then you add more and more species, so you add more species, first they coexist together, they form a stable community, that stable community gets larger and larger, but at some point you add enough species and that goes unstable. Okay, so what do you do when that goes unstable? You ask Giulio, and you listen to his talk. I'm going to say something about it, but I think Giulio is going to say much more. Okay, but the important thing for our purpose is here, the starting assumption was basically that each had its own niche, and we don't want that. Okay. So if I have one species with many closely related strains, I can't reasonably assume that each have a different niches. There's no a priori reason why their competition or other interactions with their siblings should be much stronger than with their distant cousins, right? They're all similar. They're doing slightly different things. Okay. However, the way they interact with chemicals in the environment, both things they eat, but also things that they produce and things that affect them in other ways, if you interact with DE chemicals, there's an old result in ecology that the maximum number of strains that can stably coexist is the number of chemicals. And actually, if you start making molds of it, typically it's quite a lot less than that unless you cook things up. Okay, so just stable coexistence with them competing with each other, this is the maximum you can get. And even if you take the large number of chemicals that are relevant, you know, even for E. coli in a test tube, it's clear that you get situations with the bacteria where you get many, many more strains than that, which can coexist. Okay. So the question which we would like to ask here is how can we get many more strains to coexist? You know, what kind of mechanisms will give rise to that? Okay, so I'm going to particularly focus on thinking about this pathogen host. As I said, this is the one that people say will produce a lot of diversity. So we're going to consider now one species of bacteria with a whole lot of different strains labeled by beta, and this is its population, a whole bunch of phages labeled by phi, this is their and populations. The crucial thing is the bacteria only have one niche. If I looked at the bacterial dynamics, they all have the same growth rate, they each interact only with the total number of bacteria. So they're indistinguishable from each other, except for how they interact with the phages. Okay. So they're preyed on by the phages. How much they're preyed on is given by this matrix here, and they can potentially be preyed on by any of them. Okay. So if they're closely related and the phage are closely related, a natural assumption is to say this has some average value plus a rare prop, which is approximately random, or we're going to treat as random. Okay. Some way the phages, they're all identical. They just die at this rate. They can potentially infect all the bacteria. And again, this is an average value plus a random prop. So the bacteria are identical except their interaction with the phages. The phages are generalist. They can interact with all of them, but with varying efficacies of different elements of these matrices. So an important thing to note here is that if a phage is bad for a bacteria, that means the same bacteria is good for the phage, right? Obviously. That's the nature of the hosts and pathogens of predator prey. So that means that this matrix here, the deviation from average, is going to be substantially correlated with this one here. Okay. So if I look at the Lotka-Volterra interaction matrix, the equivalent of this W here, that matrix is going to have anti-symmetric correlations across the diagonal. Okay. And that's very different than what you would get if you're competing for resources, where if you eat the same amount of resources as someone else, that's bad for them. If they eat them, it's bad for you. Okay. So this is now anti-symmetric correlations, and that turns out will make it very different. Okay, so this is now what happens if you put many strains of these bacteria phage together. And these are the basic dynamics here, what one might call an ecological kill the winner. So it's pretty obvious the basic things that happens. At some point here, say you get one of the bacteria which is doing well. Okay, it's doing well, it comes up to big population. So what happens then? Well, there's a bunch of phages which do better against that bacteria than they do against the others, or slightly better than average. So those will start coming up. Now, the ones that are way down here doesn't matter because they're way down exponentially lower. This is on a log scale. But the ones that are up here will come up, and they'll drive this one back down again. So this will come back down, some other one will go up, and this will continue. Okay. But the problem is, if you do this, you start finding you get wilder and wilder fluctuations, and at some point you drive extinctions, even if you put down this at the level of all bacteria in the ocean. Okay. So this is not a mechanism by itself which can give rise to high diversity. There needs to be some other feature in here. And one can show that this seems to be true rather generally. By the way, there's a rather nice, more or less exactly solvable model here where you assume that the interaction matrix is exactly antisymmetric and there's various exact results for those. It's pathological, it's very special, but it actually turns out it gives you the essence for understanding this and for understanding how you can rescue this this process. Okay. So can the community recover from extinctions? So the classic way to think about this, you say, okay, well, let's add some spatial dynamics with some kind of dispersal, but no gradients, everywhere is the same. And the classic thing is you assume a mainland, which is a pool of each of the species, and they can migrate here. Something goes extinct here, it's going to get repopulated. Okay. The problem is with that is it assumes the answer. Then you get to the problem of why are there so many different species on the mainland? Right? And certainly in the ocean, there's no distinction between them. These, everything is mixing together. So we don't want this. Okay. So the other way that one can think about it, the sort of next simplest thing, is to say we've got a whole bunch of islands. So we have these local populations. These islands are identical, but there's going to be migration between many of them. Okay. So now there's a potential pool of all the other islands. So if something goes extinct here, you get all the other islands. So what happens is one finds that if you're studying this, you find that some of the strains go globally extinct. So since we're not assuming an infinite surviving pool, then things can go globally extinct. But the question is, can many strains survive? Okay. So this has been worked at by Felix Roy and various collaborators, and Julia's going to talk about that, and also by two of the students that I mentioned. Okay. So we look at a multiple island model with the bacteriophages. We've got a large number of identical islands. We have many bacterial strains, many phage strains. the interaction within the islands, but the islands are the same, so the interaction matrix is the same on every island. There's migration among the islands at a low rate. And the simplest one is sort of a mean field spatial structure where I have migration from every island to every other island. Right? That's the first refuge of scoundrelous statistical mechanisms.
Sorry, why do you need the islands?
Otherwise, everything fluctuates to extinction. No, I would like to treat this in a continuum. Right. So what is this? What would be a natural model for the islands here? Okay. So the natural model Alex talked about. So the natural model is something which colonizes a host that moves around and people transmit it to each other. Right. So if you think about the bacteria in your gut, so there are some species which actually everyone has in their gut, but people have different strains. You may have a very different strain than someone in the same household, but similar strain to someone living across the world. And they have a whole range of timescales over which their last common ancestors were. There's clearly a lot of mixing. There are islands that move around, but this would be certainly a first approximation, especially now, this world for this kind of mixing. Okay. In the ocean, mixing is basically fast, and so it's sort of not unreasonable starting point. For a lot of bacteria that are studied, we have very little idea of the mixing processes and how fast or how far slow they are. Skin bacteria is actually now being studied. Tammy Lieberman's very nice things, and actually looking at kids as they come into school and mixing between them. And if you take a common species, Staph epidermidis, you have lots of different strains on your body. Some of them colonize different parts of the body, but the same part of the body, you have lots of very similar ones. Why? Right. That's relatively simple, especially compared to your gut. So how do we analyze this? Well, we have to do some spatiotemporal dynamical mean field theory here, supplemented by simulations. But as with a lot of these things, the simulations are hard to get into asymptotic regimes. Okay. So what does this do? Well, some of the strains will go globally extinct, but we get stabilization of a large fraction of the diversity by spatiotemporal chaos. Okay. So each island has chaotic dynamics. And all of the strains that survive, so some go extinct, but all the ones that survive have occasional blooms and busts. And so here I'm showing a couple of strains. There's a small fraction of the strains on one of the islands. Okay, and they're fluctuating up and down on a log scale. They're actually roughly uniformly distributed on the log scale here, which turns out to give you statistics of abundances, very similar to the theory of neutral ecology, which I didn't throw data on. And it's actually a special kind of sort of self-tuned chaos. There's something that came up yesterday. The scale, the time scale over which you go from large to low by sort of the average difference between them is the same as the time scale over which you get the fluctuations up and down a lot. Okay, so it's not at all clear. You generally have to tune a parameter to get this, but this came up in Alex's talk. And this is something which is tuned by the ecology. Okay. And these blooms and busts are absolutely crucial. Why is that? Well, if I go to here, where I go to many islands, so this is now looking at one of the surviving strains across many islands, and the chaos is asynchronous. If the migration is low, they desynchronize right away between the chaos on different islands, and that's, of course, the crucial part, right? Because the migration then feels the average over all the other islands, so the migration is coming from all the other islands. That's averaging the population from each island. This is the logarithm of the population. So it's averaging the exponential of the logarithm. So not surprisingly, as we learned at the end of the day yesterday, that's going to be dominated by the ones that are very large. So in order for a species to have a substantial population that's going to repopulate when you get a local extinction, to repopulate that, you're going to have some blooming up to large numbers on the islands. Okay. So one can do a self-consistent analysis for a minute. It's actually rather interesting and subtle, is that you get these fluctuations here. They're not a random walk. They're non-trivial exponent and so on. And one has to understand the statistics of these blooms and busts in order to understand the nature of this this phase. So the crucial part is that if the blooms on other islands, and in a large number of islands, always some going on, they will repopulate after local extinction. Okay, so this will stabilize this this phase. Okay, so this diverse spatiotemporal chaotic phase, and I'm now calling it phase because it's something which is quite robust to changing the model around, changing parameters, and so on. And Giulio is going to talk about other aspects of a phase in a somewhat different regime, I think. The behavior is very robust, the qualitative behavior, and some of the quantitative behavior. A crucial part is this. Okay? If you have some modest number of islands, then you can by chance have no bloom happening on any island, and if ever it's unlucky, the whole species at a time, it will go extinct. It'll go globally extinct. Okay? So one has to understand the statistics of those rare events when you fail to bloom on all the islands for long enough that the sort of global population starts going down and you reach the sort of extinction floor and they all go extinct. And that will happen, but the time it takes to happen is exponentially long in the number of islands with a coefficient which depends on the strain. So some strains will fluctuate through extinction relatively easy. Some strains go deterministically extinct. Some can fluctuate extinction, but even with tens of islands, a large fraction of the strains survive essentially indefinitely. So of course, we would like to add features to this. We'd like to add real spatial dispersal, starting with short-range interactions or short-range dispersal, long-range. In addition to that, would like to ask about if I have an environment which is also changing, so I have environmental gradients and temporal variations, what does that do to this? And again, Giulio may say something about this this part. Particularly, we would like to understand with ocean mixing, the nice thing with the oceans, we're understanding a lot about the mixing, and what will this give rise to? In particular, what would I expect the spatiotemporal correlations of the abundances? It's known if you just take samples of seawater and you count how many there are of all the bugs in there, they go blooming up and down in the lab even. Okay, so there's clearly a lot of blooms. The number of ones that are sort of similar doesn't change much. So if you sort of look at it, it seems pretty stable. And the sort of overall ecology is stable, but there are different species coming up and down and different strains bouncing up and down all the time. Okay, so clearly one would like to understand something about the statistics of that. One would actually like to have some real honest predictions. Okay, so now I want to come back to this question which I asked previously about how much complexity is enough to get this. Okay, so I cheated. I just wrote down there was an interaction matrix. If I put 10 million different phages and 10 million different bacterial strains, there are 100 billion parameters in there. But obviously, how they interact is determined by the organisms. It's not determined by just some random random matrix elements. Okay. So I want to put in the simplest caricature of the interactions. So I've got a bacteria which has some receptor on it. Each bacteria has a vector, d-dimensional vector here, labeled by x. The phage has a tail. The tail combined to it, again, a d-dimensional vector. So the interaction between the bacteria beta and phage phi is just given by simply just by the dot product of these to the interaction energy. And then the bacterial death and the phage population growth are deterministic functions of this. So they're just a function of the death of this binding, and so is the phage population growth. Okay? So these are clearly going to be correlated to each other. If E is large, then both G and F are going to be large. Okay? So these are going to be correlated with each other, as I said. But here now we've got a model where we've got the phenotype that's carried around. Okay? So what happens? Well, you can get a spatiotemporally chaotic phase again with this, with these generalist phages, if I make this function isn't sharply peaked somewhere, but has just a characteristic behavior. If you do the obvious thing, you say they're similar to each other, I want to linearize this, you say this is roughly linear, then you get back to a result like coexisting via chemicals, interacting via chemicals, is the maximum you can get is of order the dimension here. However, if you put a more interesting function, so we're now taking a low-rank matrix, this is very low rank, and I'm taking nonlinear functions of the elements of the matrix, so I could take sigmoidal functions here, and then one finds, at least at our level of understanding, that you can get arbitrarily high diversity even with very low-dimensional interactions. So here we have really simple interactions. We've not put high complexity in there. Nevertheless, we can get high diversity. This is just showing the matrix of interactions that you get out. I mean, it's not much pattern to it. Those are the ones that survive, and those are the ones that are extinct. It's hard, actually, to figure out from the statistics which ones would do which, because they're making this whole self-consistent state. Each one is feeling the effects of many others. Okay. So here, then, we can say we at least have a toy scenario. And not something which is at least close to a caricature model, which shows that we can get high diversity even from simple biology, with assuming nothing about niches. We didn't assume niches anywhere along this. Okay, so the last bit then is whether this can evolve. Can you evolve a diverse chaotic community? So we're just going to evolve the bacterial receptors and tails, and this is still very much work in progress. Aditya Mahadevan's doing this. Does the diversity increase? Does it saturate? Or does it crash? And the answer is yes. Okay, so this is something, there is not a universal answer. Not surprisingly, we've got phases that aren't diverse, we've got phases that are diverse, we don't a priori know which one we're in. Okay. However, there is a yes to this one, and at least at our level of understanding so far, it appears that one can be in a regime where the number of phage bacteria and the number of bacteria will continuously grow. We're assuming slow evolution here. This is the hardest regime. Things can go extinct between every new mutation. The phages don't seem to become substantially more specialist or more generalist. The diversification can almost certainly continue forever. Whether it tends to saturate and start growing logarithmically, we don't know yet. Okay. However, it does seem as if we can get red queen evolution with continual diversification, without specialization, and the sort of big question here is whether they're slowing down. Okay. So the last sort of thing, here, you can look at the phylogenies, the family trees of these, and a question then for Alex is whether you can distinguish these from other kinds of phylogenies. It's not at all clear. We'd obviously like to have testable predictions. It's not clear if this will be. Okay, so the conclusions and questions. So the simple models then can play a role of decreasing our surprise. Maybe, I'm certainly less surprised by extensive fine-scale diversity than I was before. The bacteriophage then can stabilize high diversity with simple biology. We would like, of course, to have testable predictions, correlations of abundances. That basically almost all the data is going to be from DNA sequencing, so we'd like to be able to predict statistics there. Okay. For the evolution now, it looks as if you can get these phases, continual red queen evolution with continual diversification. You get turnover of species, but the number of the strains continue to grow. Okay. Are pathogens needed? I said we're going to look at the case of pathogens. Can you get, by interaction via chemicals in the environment, can you also get phases in which you could stabilize this sort of spatiotemporal chaos and stabilize chaotic diversity and stabilize large number of strains, even when they're interacting through modest number of chemicals? So that's an open question which we're trying to think about. Okay. And finally, a note, is this even the right question? Okay, so it's become clear in recent years that many bacteria, and I say almost everyone anyone looks at in detail, they're said to be primarily asexual, occasionally they exchange genes. But if you look at them in detail, you discover that they're sort of quasi-sexual. The correlations in mutations along a genome of some bacteria are shorter range measured in units of mutations than they are in humans. Okay, so there's a lot of the features which I say there a lot of sexual aspects of the population. So really, it's not clear whether we should be thinking about diversity of strains or genomes or the diversity of genes. Okay, and now it starts seeing with Alana's analysis that Proclorococcus, which was thought to be very little sexual, is actually already in this category. So now I seem to have been cut off. That's fortunate. That was my last word. Okay. So I think there's something gone wrong with the projector, but... okay. Well, hopefully it's something. Anyway, that was where I was ending anyway, so the timing was wonderful.